We interrupt this program for a special news bulletin. Three young singers were killed today in the crash of a light plane in an Iowa snow flurry. The singers were identified as Richie Valens, 17, Buddy Holly, 22, and J.P. Richardson, known professionally as the Big Bopper.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. On February 3rd, 1959, that plane crash took four lives. The music of three of those men who died lives on. Today we're going to talk about Buddy Holly, how his music changed rock and roll, and how he continues to touch people today. My first guest, Gary Moore, discovered the music of Buddy Holly late in life, but it sent him on a remarkable journey. And later I'll talk with Jeff Nicholas, who's the president of the North Iowa Cultural Center and Museum located in the Surf Ballroom. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. On February 3rd, 1959, a small plane crashed outside of Mason City, Iowa. On that plane, as you probably know, were rock and roll greats Buddy Holly, Richie Valens, and the Big Bopper. For many, that day is known as the day that the music died. But for my first guest, Gary Moore, that day meant nothing. He was 4 years old when it happened. He has no memory of it until recently. He really didn't care. Now Gary Moore is the author of Hey Buddy, In Pursuit of Buddy Holly, My New Buddy John, and My Lost Decade of Music. And Gary, until very recently, you didn't really know anything about Buddy Holly, but you had an experience that made you want to find out more. What happened?
Well, what happened is it's hard to explain. I knew nothing about Buddy Holly, cared nothing about Buddy Holly, but my mother-in-law, who lives in Independence, Iowa, the only thing she wanted for her 77th birthday was to go to a reenactment of the winter dance party at the University of Northern Iowa. So we agreed, you know, and I thought, well, I could bear it for a couple hours to put up with that. And we went to the Gallagher Blue Dorn Performing Arts Center, which is just gorgeous, a beautiful facility. And there from the stage, the late great Buddy Holly kind of reached out and seized my heart and captivated my imagination through a song that he didn't even write, but it was written by John Mueller.
Well, we'll talk more about that song in a moment. But for people who don't know the history, the Winter Dance Party, that's the concert that Buddy Holly, Richie Valens, and the Big Bopper, also Dion was there that night as well, although he did not get on that plane.
Right.
That was the concert tour that they were doing all over the Midwest. It was really a grueling concert tour that they were on.
Yeah, it was zigzagging across. Anybody who's looked at the tour can only come up with the fact that they didn't have a map in New York. And so when they were setting this up, they really gave very little consideration to the impact it would have on the performers and the amount of travel involved.
So you were at that night at a recreation, or at least a partial recreation, of that event. And it had a Buddy Holly impersonator,
right,
John Mueller. It had a Richie Valens impersonator and a Big Bopper impersonator,
right,
as well. The son of the Big Bopper, was he the
performer? Jay Richardson, absolutely.
Right.
And then Ray Anthony was performing as Richie Valens.
And you, when you heard the music of Buddy Holly, before we even get to that original composition, what was going through your mind when you were hearing these songs? Because you recognized them, right?
Well, I recognized all of them, to my surprise. But I didn't realize it was Buddy Holly. You know, I'd hear this song and say, I thought that was Linda Ronstadt. I'd hear this, I thought this was James Taylor. And I was absolutely impressed. I was really, really surprised at the level of musicality. The performance level was incredibly high. In fact, I kept thinking that I would be surprised if the regional performers were really this good. I mean, it was excellent. But at the end of it all, my wife looked at me towards the end. She says, are you enjoying it? And I said, yeah, it's great, but I wouldn't want to do it again. It still wasn't something that had, grabbed me until the very end.
All around you, there were people who did remember that music, did care about that music. How was the rest of the crowd reacting?
Oh, it was a fascinating study of cultural study of this age demographic. I mean, these were largely, I mean, there were young people there, certainly, but it was largely people, I would say, 55 to 75. And they were reliving their youth, and they were so enthused and excited. And it was just, I mean, it was hard not to be in the spirit just hanging around them.
At the end of his set, John Mueller, the man who was portraying Buddy Holly, said, "I'm going to now perform an original song that I wrote as a tribute to Buddy Holly." What went through your mind when he said that?
Well, first thing that went through my mind was, this is going to be a train wreck. Here we've had all this great music by this former great performer, and now this guy who's, and I referred to him at the time, and I'm embarrassed that I did, this impersonator is now going to throw in something that he's written, and it couldn't possibly live up. But I was wrong.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of that song right now. This is John Mueller with his song, "Hey Buddy."
A small chartered airplane crashed in a snow-covered field outside Clear Lake, Iowa this morning. Rock and roll performers Buddy Holly, Richie Valens, J.P. the Big Bopper Richardson were killed in a plane crash in the early hours this morning, February the 3rd, 1959.
"Hey buddy, look at me, I'm just sitting here reminiscing, and I know your words of love will not fade away, but something's still missing. Well, alright, but it's so easy to feel this way. I started wishing you were here, but I know that'll be the day, and maybe, baby, I shouldn't be so sad, but it starts raining my heart when I think of all you had. Hey, buddy, I got those early in the morning blues, but I'm gonna set my foot right down with my valley of tears. Got nothing to lose, gonna start rocking around with old Ali B. Every day a rock-a-bye rock will be the cure for me. Yeah, I'm gonna tell my blues, don't you come back knocking, 'cause I'm a changing all those changes now, and I'll be here rocking. Hey buddy, rave on and sing us a song. Baby, won't you come out tonight? We're all looking for someone to love down here to help us make it through these blue days and black nights."
That's some of "Hey Buddy," performed by John Mueller. And Gary, when you heard that song, what happened to you?
The opening words are, "Hey buddy." Then he says, "Look at me." And I did. And as I listened to the words and listened to the melody, I just, my heart started racing. I felt so tuned in. And it was as if he was singing only to me. And not to me as much as he was singing to Buddy Holly, you know, and I had a personal audience. And it seemed very intimate at, you know, my wife looked over at me at one point, and I had tears running down my face, and that's not like me. And she grabbed my arm and said, "Are you okay?" And I said, "Yeah, I think so, but I'm not sure." And it seized my heart, seized my mind, and sent me on this journey that became this book.
So you went home that night, you turned on the laptop, and you started trying to find out everything you could about Buddy Holly, but also about John Mueller.
Yeah, I typed in Buddy Holly into Google, and I'm certain it's the first time I've ever typed the words Buddy and Holly together at the same time in my life. I was 55 years old. And to my shock, there were 9,136,000 web opportunities to learn about Buddy Holly. And the first thing that went through my mind is, how is it that I have gotten to this point in my life that I know nothing? And it seems like everybody knows everything. And so I started reading, and the next thing you know, it was 5 o'clock in the morning, and I wrote the first fan letter of my life. But I wasn't sure if was I writing a fan letter to Buddy Holly, to John Mueller, or was I a fan of the song? I didn't know. But I just sent John a letter saying, "I'd love to talk to you. I don't really know why, but hope we can have a conversation."
A lot of us have had experiences in our life where we're really touched by music or really moved by music, or a particular performer really reaches out and touches us. And for most of us, that results in buying a bunch of records, reading fan magazines, reading a biography, or, you know, that kind of thing. But for you, it sent you on this really life-changing journey.
Yes.
What did you do next?
Well, I started to, you know, I'm a writer. And in some ways, the way I write, it's almost like quilt making. I'm constantly writing little snippets. You know, on one day I'll feel this way, and I want to capture that feeling, and I don't know why, but I'll just write a few paragraphs and I'll file it away. Well, I started writing and filing away my feelings and my thoughts, and I'd listen to the song, and something would come to me. I'd write, and I start just kind of putting all this away, and I still wasn't. I really hadn't had any thought that this would mean anything or that I would write something, because I thought, well, this is a very personal thing I'm going through. I should maybe be embarrassed to admit all this, but I wanted to capture it. Then the more I would read, the more I would study, the more I would look, I started taking these little snippets and quilting it together, and I thought, well, this is an interesting story. Contacted one of my publishers that I've worked with, Ted Savas, and I contacted him first because he's from Mason City. He runs Savas Beattie Publishing. They're headquartered in New York, but their editorial office is in California. And I said, hey, I want to write something about Buddy Holly. And he said, don't bother. He said, there's nothing new to say. And I said, well, this really isn't about Buddy Holly. And he said, what's it about? And I said, I don't know, but I'll send you what I've written. And he said, let me know. Well, normally a proposal like that can take, you know, 6 months to a year and a half. He called me back 30 minutes later and he says, I'm all in. He said, let's get it done. But he said, you have to have this done in time to be out for the anniversary. Well, that was a pretty daunting task, but it had captivated every cell of my body. So I thought, well, I can't do anything else for the next year anyway, so I might as well do it. So, and now I'm sitting here with you.
Right. And you set out to write a book, but you didn't set out to write a biography of Buddy Holly. What story, and we'll talk about the story that you did tell, but when you first set out, what story did you think you were going to tell?
I really didn't know. I mean, this is a classic case of how not to write a book. I mean, I had no outline. I had no real idea. What I was doing was just capturing the emotion and the feelings that I was going through and then attaching it to what I was learning at the time. And for the first, I guess for the first 3 months, I just didn't know what the outcome would be. Then as I started meeting unusual people who had similar experiences or were just absolutely fascinated by Buddy, I started realizing that I would write this journey that I was going through and intermix other people who were having similar experiences as we go along. And I thought, well, this will be great, and I'll enjoy it, whether anybody else will or not. I sent it off to my publisher, and his first words were, this isn't the book that I bought. And I said, well, it's the book that I've sent you, so it's too late to do anything about it.
Well, we will talk more about Buddy Holly and the personal journey that you took in discovering his music and discovering more about the man and more about yourself as well in just a moment. My guest is Gary Moore. He is the author of In Pursuit of Buddy, or Hey Buddy, In Pursuit of Buddy Holly, My New Buddy John, and My Lost Decade of Music. Also, we'll be talking in a few minutes with Jeff Nicholas, who's the president of the North Iowa Cultural Center and Museum located in the Surf Ballroom, which, of course, is the site of Buddy Holly's last performance. This is Talk of Iowa.
Every day, it's a getting closer, going faster than a roller coaster. Love like yours will surely come my way. Hey, hey, hey. Every day, it's a getting faster. Everyone said, go ahead and ask her. Love like yours will surely come my way.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we're talking about Buddy Holly. My guest is Gary Moore. He's the author of a new book. It's called Hey Buddy, In Pursuit of Buddy Holly, My New Buddy John, and My Lost Decade of Music. And in a few minutes, we'll be joined by Jeff Nicholas, who's the president of the North Iowa Cultural Center and Museum located in the Surf Ballroom, which, of course, is the site of Buddy Holly's final performance before that plane crash on February 3rd, 1959. And we'd love to hear from you as well. Did you see Buddy Holly perform when he was in Iowa? Do you remember the day that plane crash occurred? Share your memories. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Gary, one of the really interesting things I find about your book is that as you started to research Buddy Holly and look more into his life and listen to his music with fresh ears, really listen to his performances of his music. Many of his songs, as you mentioned, have been covered by many other artists throughout the years. You kept running into people who had really strong connections with Buddy Holly, and just by coincidence, you would run into them.
Oh, absolutely. It's the only way I can explain it. It's kind of like I bought a car one time. And it was the most unusual color I'd ever seen. And I thought when I bought it, nobody else has a car like this. And just driving it from the dealership to my house, I saw five or six other cars that way. And once I became aware of Buddy Holly, I find out that I am really in the minority, that the fact that he has come to me so late. And not just people who are fans, people who are rabid fans, people who are just feel such an emotional connection to Buddy Holly. And I think the part of that is because Buddy reminds us of the boy next door. I don't think people ever related to John, Lennon or Paul McCartney quite in the same way. He didn't seem like the kid that grew up next door. I mean, they were, from across the ocean, had a different accent, come from really a different culture. But Buddy was, he wore a Cub Scout uniform like I did. He grew up in a home about the same size I did. You know, he was a typical American kid.
I was surprised by how many young people you found who were diehard Buddy Holly fans.
Oh. Yeah, I ran across on Facebook a young lady who, 27 years old, just says that Buddy is the love of her life and goes on and on and on. But then she has a full-size face of Buddy tattooed on her back and her shoulder. And, that is devotion. That is absolute devotion. And she's been that way since she's 12 years old. And she's not alone. It just everywhere I turn, from calling Southwest Airlines to make reservations, I encounter a Peggy Sue that's named after the record, to people all across the country who want to tell their Buddy Holly stories.
And you also did seek out people who knew Buddy Holly, who experienced his performances when he was in Iowa. And one of the places you went was Electric Park Ballroom in Waterloo. He performed there.
Right.
And the picture that's on the cover of your book of Buddy Holly sitting on an old freezer, tuning his guitar, wearing sunglasses, that
right.
was taken in the kitchen of the Electric Park Ballroom.
It is. This is most experts, Buddy Holly, in fact, they all say this is the most famous Buddy Holly photograph ever taken. It's the one that his wife and his brother say they love the most. And when you ask them, they say that it's the first picture where Buddy is completely natural. He's just sitting relaxed, tuning his guitar, not even aware that a picture is being taken, really. And they said you can see his facial features changing from a boy to a man. And as you look at that, you can see that.
The man who took that photograph was Dick Cole.
Yes, yes.
Tell me about your conversations with Dick Cole.
Well, he's delightful, and he was so giving and so willing to talk. And Dick said something that surprised me. And at first I thought, I don't believe this. But as I checked into it, he's really quite accurate. First of all, he told me I'm more famous in Japan than I am in Waterloo, Iowa, where I live. But the other thing he said 3 days out of the year, he said, I feel like the most famous photographer in the world. About February 1st, 2nd, 3rd, he said papers from all over the world. He said from Tokyo to Des Moines, they're running this picture, and they all want to call and talk to me. And he said they all asked the same questions. They said, what did you and Buddy talk about? And Dick says, I really don't even remember. He says, I was in awe sitting there looking at Buddy Holly and just couldn't believe I had the opportunity to snap his picture.
Tell me a little bit about Buddy Holly's experience when he was performing in Waterloo, because you have found out a little bit about that performance and the people that he met then.
Well, one of the things I found out is Buddy and Iowans are forever tied together. And Buddy seemed to love Iowa. He performed here on two different tours. And actually, when he was in Waterloo in July 1958, he made friends with a lot of people in the crowd, and he went water skiing the next day out on the Cedar River, and had promised them to come back the next summer, and he was going to spend a week here. And of course, he wasn't around to fulfill that promise. But it doesn't surprise me. I mean, I love Iowa. My wife's from here. We've been married for 36 years, and I have family here. Some of my best friends are here. But as I visit Lubbock and I travel on Iowa, It's a very similar culture. It's rural America. The people are very genuine, and so I can see why Buddy loved Iowa, and I can see why Iowans love Buddy.
I want to bring Jeff Nicholas on now. He is, as I mentioned before, the president of the North Iowa Cultural Center and Museum, located in the Surf Ballroom in Clear Lake. Hello, Jeff.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here.
I'm glad to be here.
And I know that you also don't remember this crash. This happened when you were a year old, so this wasn't a part of your cultural experience. But when did you first start listening to Buddy Holly and find out about what happened?
Well, it wasn't until the late 1970s. In fact, my family, in addition to my involvement at the surf, my family actually owns the farm where the guys went down. And I spent my high school summers picking rock on that farm and actually have a bad back to this day because of that. But did not know that anything of significance happened there while I was doing it. And it wasn't until 1979 when a local DJ named the Mad Hatter started the tributes to Buddy that the focus became on Buddy. And then we had a fan from Green Bay, Wisconsin, by the name of Ken Paquette, that did the research and went out and found where the spot was and placed the markers there. And be honest with you, I spent most of my life not even knowing or understanding. And I think a lot of the community of Clear Lake kind of, it wasn't our finest hour. The crash was not our finest hour. And I think we just kind of tried to put it out of our minds and kind of be done with it for a period of time. And then thankfully the Mad Hatter began to make us all aware of it again. And of course it's just continued to blossom from there.
People from all over the world come to Clear Lake to see the surf ballroom, to go to that crash site. When that first started happening, how did you react?
Well, we've certainly been criticized for allowing people out there, and we've started to call it the memorial site rather than the crash site. But probably the single most asked question at the Chamber of Commerce and at restaurants, at hotels around Clear Lake is, where in fact is the memorial site? And as you might guess, the weather in the winter is pretty treacherous up here. So rather than have people go out and just search blindly for it, and sometimes find it, sometimes not. In fact, a guy ran in the ditch 2 years ago trying to find it and ended up writing a song about it. But we've actually have directions at the surf and directions at the chamber, and most of the local hotels have directions to it. So we were a little reticent at the beginning to allow people out there. But then, you know, as the outpouring of love and support for Buddy and Richie and the Bopper became evident, it was obvious that really wasn't our place. It was really the fans of rock and roll. It's really their place. And it really, truly is a very emotional place for a lot of people.
Absolutely. And Gary, you write about your visit to the crash site in the book, and that's really the way you end the book, is with your journey there. What compelled you to go there?
You know, the deeper I'd get into the story, the more I'd learn. I felt drawn there in a way that, I realized that at some point I couldn't not go. It was a place I felt compelled to visit. I had to visit. When I arrived there, I responded and reacted much different than I thought I would. And I'm glad I was the only one there. But I was so touched that whoever owned that field would allow people to come in. In fact, there was a marker, which I didn't see until I was leaving, that I entered the wrong side of the field. I had a great encounter with the farmer master that lived across the street, and had a great conversation with him. And so it was just an incredible experience that I could never recreate. I mean, next time I go there, it'll be different. But it was one of the most unusual and one of the most moving experiences of my life.
Your conversation with the farmer who doesn't own that land, obviously,
right.
Jeff Nicholas, your family owns that land, but he lives right across, and he actually does remember the crash.
He does.
That was a fascinating conversation, though. He's never been to the crash site.
He's never been there. And at first,
it's half a mile away from his house.
Right. And at first I thought, well, I can't believe that, you know. Then he told me they've never farmed that field, his family, so there's no reason for him to go out there. And he this look of sadness came over him when I tried to get him to go with me. And I thought, well, I'll be the first one to take him out there. And he said, nah, you go. He said, there's nothing there but sadness. And so he said he's never been there and he'll never go.
Ray is on the line with us from Mason City. Hello, Ray.
Hi.
Hi.
I personally never went to the concert. I remember when it went on because a few days before, I was riding around with a friend, and he says, Richie Valens is going to be at the surf. And I said, who is Richie Valens? Only one I knew of the three was the Big Bopper. But a friend of mine, well, many friends of mine were over there. And one of them, they were visiting with a big bopper during the break. And he actually wore the big bopper's jacket and tried to buy it.
Oh, wow.
And Big Bopper almost sold it to him, and he said, "Oh, I can't do that. That's a trademark." And just think what that would have. Now, that gentleman is now dead. But we had our 40th, I think, class reunion over there. So I was a senior in high school when that went on. And we had our 40th, part of our 40th class reunion. You know, there were 45th, I guess. Or no, 40th. I was right the first time. But we took the tour, and but when he turned and asked, which he normally does, how many were here that night, and 3/4 of the hands went up.
Wow.
The difference was those people had been there. If you ask that question to now, all the people that said they've been there, that building couldn't hold them.
So those were the people who actually were there that night. When you heard about the crash, Ray, the next day, how did you react?
I just thought it was, a sad situation, even though I didn't know nothing about many of them. What made me sick is that the guy that made the record years or months later about the 3 stars, I thought made me sick that somebody makes money on death.
Mm. How did your classmates react, though? Obviously, these people were very important to a lot of them.
I'm not even sure if this is a gentleman or not that I know him that you're talking to, but they were looking for photographs of that, you know, people had taken that day.
Uh-huh.
And I asked a lot of the classmates and they says, "We didn't take any pictures." Says, who knew that was going to be a big deal?
Right.
You know, it was just another night of, you know, going out and having fun.
A great concert.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Ray, thank you so much for calling.
You're welcome.
Jeff, when people go to the Surf Ballroom, to the North Iowa Cultural Center and Museum, what do they see?
Well, I'm glad you asked that because, Gary, I read your book the last couple of days, and I just want to compliment you. It's an absolutely incredible book.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
You know, I'm kind of an emotional guy like you are, and I can't say I was in tears, but I was very emotional about several of the stories that you wrote about, but when I got done, I have this huge feeling of emptiness, and that emptiness comes from your not being able to come in the surf, and I would like to invite you to come to the surf because when you talk about. This gentleman talked about photographs for 50 years. All the photographs were taken at all the other venues. Obviously, the great photograph of Buddy on the freezer in Waterloo. But nobody ever came up with any photographs of the show here. I mean, nobody knows why, except at our 50th anniversary, and it's an incredible story. It's so long. It's something you can't hardly believe, but there was two young kids from southern Minnesota that came to the show and took pictures and went home and had them developed and threw them in their closet. And 40 years later, their mother had passed away, and they were looking through her things and found these photographs. And we have those photographs, the only photographs in the entire world of Buddy here, Buddy Richie. There are no pictures of the bopper, unfortunately, but we have Buddy and Richie here at the surf on stage, and they're absolutely breathtaking photographs. And there's so much here. There's so much here about Buddy and Richie and the bopper and all the people that have played here at the surf. And you can, I'd love to take you up the stairs that Buddy went up and take you onto the stage where Buddy played. And the surf's a real, real special place, and I'd just like to invite you to come here.
Oh, I would love to. In fact, I'm going to be in Mason City and Clear Lake on the 5th, and I actually tried to get tickets to go to the surf, and I couldn't get any. So if you can get me in, I'd love to be there.
Well, you and I need to talk when we're done here.
Okay.
I will take care of that. The other comment that the last gentleman had, you know, his concern that somebody's making money off this. What we're about here at the SERP is to preserve and to promote mm-hmm. not only the music but the life and times of Buddy and Richie and the Bopper. And our event each February is an incredible celebration of their lives and their music. And we use the word "not fade" or the title "not fade away" kind of is one of our mottos, because in no way are we doing this to celebrate or to think about what happened. We're doing it in celebration of their life and their music.
Well, we will talk more about their lives and their music in just a moment. My guests are Jeff Nicholas. He's the president of the North Iowa Cultural Center and Museum, located in the SERP Ballroom, which, of course, was the site of that performance on February 2nd, the winter dance party featuring Buddy Holly, Richie Valens, and the Big Bopper, also Dion that night. Dion was not on the plane, of course, that went down after midnight on February 3rd, 1959. My other guest is Gary Moore. He's the author of Hey Buddy, In Pursuit of Buddy Holly, My New Buddy John, and My Lost Decade of Music. This is Talk of Iowa.
It's so easy to fall in love. It's so easy to fall in love. So here I go, breaking all of the rules. It seems so easy.
Seems so easy, seems so easy.
Oh, so doggone easy.
Doggone easy, doggone easy.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we're talking about Buddy Holly. My guest is Gary Moore. He's the author of Hey Buddy, In Pursuit of Buddy Holly, My New Buddy John, My Lost Decade of Music. He discovered Buddy Holly late in life, and it sent him, this music sent him on a really remarkable journey. Also with us is Jeff Nicholas. He's the president of the North Iowa Cultural Center and Museum, located in the SERP Ballroom, which is the site of Buddy Holly's final performance. And his family also owns the land where the memorial site, that's where the plane crashed, right outside of Mason City. You're welcome to join our conversation with your memories at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And I want to talk about the winter dance party, February 2nd at the SERP Ballroom. And of course, we had talked a little bit earlier about the tour that had been going on. This was a really grueling tour, zigzagging all over this part of the Midwest. And Jeff, can you set the scene for us? What that night would have been like at the SERP?
Well, yeah, it was actually a Monday night, and one of the biggest rock and roll shows in the nation was coming to Clear Lake, so it was an incredible amount of excitement. The guys came in the afternoon on their bus, and the bus had broken down several times. The heater was not working on the bus. Carl Bunch, who was Buddy's drummer, Buddy was not with the Crickets at the time. They were separated, and he had Tommy Alsup playing lead guitar and Waylon Jennings playing bass guitar. Carl Bunch had gotten frostbitten riding on the bus, so he was in a hospital in Wisconsin. Some of the guys talked that they actually laid on top of each other and put blankets over themselves to keep warm, laid down in the aisles of the bus. And, there was just a lot of excitement. You know, I will agree with the gentleman that called in earlier. If everybody that was at that concert that has told me they've been at that concert the last 10 years, then we have a facility quite larger than we do. Because thousands of people have said they were at that facility. I think the best guess is I think there were about 1,200 people. The manager at the time, Carol Anderson, invited parents to come along, and they stood around the dance floor, kind of watching their kids. You know, that was the time when people thought rock and roll was going to destroy our society, and so he wanted to show the parents that it probably wasn't going to happen. And during the afternoon, Buddy came to Carol and asked if there was any way that he could charter him an airplane to go to their next destination. And then, of course, Carol called Dwyer Air Service, and of course, the rest is history.
One of the details that you write about in your book, Gary, of that concert that I think is just remarkable, and Jeff, you just mentioned that Buddy Holly's drummer had frostbite, and so he could not perform. So they are. They're getting ready for the concert, and they don't have a drummer. So what did they do, Gary?
Well, Buddy agreed to play the drums for everyone, and then Richie Valens would play drums for Buddy. And I think it really – the more I explored and learned about Buddy's personality, this doesn't surprise me. I mean, Buddy Holly is as close to an egoless individual that you could find. And the idea of serving others was important to him. And so the fact, you know, hey, yeah, I'm one of the biggest stars in America now, but sure, I'll sit behind and play drums. And, you know, with the without an internet and things we have, people didn't recognize him. And so he sat back there and played, and it wasn't until Bob Hale announced him that he jumped up that everybody realized, oh, that's Buddy Holly.
That's a wonderful, wonderful
and
detail.
And we, in fact, in one of those pictures that we have, the only pictures that were ever discovered, there is a picture of Buddy playing drums in
that's amazing.
That show. Yeah.
Oh, that's just wonderful. Well, let's talk a little bit about Buddy's personality since you bring it up. Because now, of course, he died 52 years ago.
Right.
And people don't often speak ill of the dead. But no one had a bad word to say about Buddy Holly.
No, and I've really tried. I mean, I was really searching for someone. And I said to a couple of friends, I said, you're describing this guy as though he's perfect. And they'd say, oh, no, Buddy's not perfect. He was just a nice guy. And, the folks that had recorded with him said that he never raised his voice. People would make mistakes, and he would just laugh and say, hey, we'll have to do that over again and do it. And he was a man who was of deep faith, didn't wear it on a sleeve, but certainly lived it. You know, lived out his faith. So he was a remarkable young man.
You, talking to his friends, some of whom recorded with him, you discovered that his first royalty check he spent on pews for his church, new pews for his church.
Yeah, and that's remarkable because his church was really out in front against him. You know, I'm a Christian, and I admit that the worst things about Christianity, sometimes all of us Christians. At the time, they didn't understand the music, and they were out in front of it saying that this is the devil's music, but they took his money, and they bought the pews. And Buddy realized that, you know, that they were wrong, and he'd be fine. I mean, he knew his heart, you know. But when you think about it, his first royalty check in today's dollars was about $36,000. Here's a young man from kind of a lower middle-income family. He didn't buy an Italian sports car. He didn't go on a trip. He donated the whole thing to his church, so...
Dennis is on the line from Cedar Rapids. Hello, Dennis.
Yes.
Hi, and we brought up the fact that Waylon Jennings was playing with Buddy Holly, and there's a story that has often been told about Waylon Jennings giving up his seat on that plane that night, and you say that's an urban legend?
That is an urban legend. I'm 66. I believed that until about 2 years ago, and then looking at the concert on YouTube, Tommy Alsup, who was with the band, along with Waylon Jennings, he was interested in going on the plane, too. And he ended up flipping a coin with Richie Valens and also lost the coin flip and therefore didn't get to go on the plane, whereas Richie Valens did. There's a six-minute bit on YouTube by Tommy Alsup, who is still alive, where he goes into this. But I think probably hundreds of thousands of people thought for years that it was Waylon Jennings, probably due to the fact that Waylon Jennings, of course, went on and had a huge country career.
Well, and
so
Gary,
if,
you... Dennis, thanks. Thanks for bringing that up.
What the author says, okay?
No, it doesn't contradict at all. But it's two different issues. Yes, there was a coin flip, but Tommy also flipped the coin. In fact, still has the coin, and he gave up his seat to Richie Valens. But Buddy chartered the plane for he and Waylon and Tommy, and the Big Bopper went to Waylon and said, "I'm having flu symptoms. I'd like to get there early and see a doctor. Would you give up your seat?" And Waylon said, "Yeah, he'd do that."
So both
and that's from Waylon's lips. I talked to some people who had interviewed Waylon.
All right. Well, Dennis, thank you so much for your call and for bringing that up. That's really fascinating. One of the other fascinating things in your book is that after this crash, Gary, the Winter Dance Party tour continued?
It did. They went on to Moorhead, Minnesota, and they had just decided they would continue. And the Boone, I forget his first name, the announcer on the radio, was saying that they were going to continue anyway. And a young man, 15 years old, Robert Valine, had a little garage band, he and his brother and a couple other artists. And they said, well, let's call them and see if they'll let us perform in Buddy Holly's place. And to their shock, to their surprise, and to my shock and surprise, they called the announcer. And he said, yeah. He says, just be down here on time. And he said, wear shirts that match. And so they did. And when they arrived, they said, well, what's the name of your band? And they looked at each other, and they didn't know. And they said, well, we guessed the Shadows. And at that moment, Bobby V and the Shadows were born.
That's crazy. I can't believe that the tour would continue. Obviously, that was a huge break for Bobby V and his band. But I can't believe that today that would never happen. A tour like that wouldn't continue after three performers had been killed.
No, it wouldn't. And I don't know for sure. I don't think the tour completed. I think that they did cancel the last few dates. But it did go on the very next night. I know that.
Jeff, I'm sure that you have heard every possible conspiracy theory that has ever come up about that crash, and I know that there have been a lot. So when people visit your museum, what do they learn about what happened that night?
Well, like I said, we really don't deal too much with the actual crash. We deal more with the Winter Dance Party tour and what happened here that night and the guys' lives and their legacies. We do have a set of headphones that the Roger Peterson, the pilot, wore on that fateful trip. And you're right, there is a lot of conspiracy. There are a lot of conspiracy theories and a lot of mystery. The FAA report said it was pilot error. I know Jerry Dwyer disputes that. About 10 years ago, there was a doctor from California that was examining some crash site photos and claimed that he saw that there was a bullet in the back seat of the pilot seat. There's some discrepancy about who sat where in the plane and where they ended up and. You know, I don't know that we'll ever know exactly what happened. You know, and I know Jerry Dwyer has some information that we'd all like to see and know. I don't know that that'll ever come out. Out of respect for Jerry and Barb, I've just always kind of let them deal with that. But it's a huge mystery, and it was one of the most major events in the history of rock and roll.
Gary, in your book, you didn't intend to go in and to try to figure out what happened during that crash, but you ended up looking into it because there are conspiracy theories,
right.
And there were things you'd heard, and you actually have experience as a pilot yourself.
I'm a pilot, and I also ran a charter service, you know, just like the Dwyers, and so I have a lot of experience and background there. And like Jeff, this book was not – I wasn't even going to deal with it. But I did want to talk to Jerry Dwyer and his wife and interview him, see if they would, and they didn't, but just ask him how kind of that brush with Buddy Holly that night impacted their lives. Well, I talked to Barb, and you know, the Dwyers, I know they're wonderful people. I'm sure they are. Everybody says they are. And so I don't want to disturb them in their you know, later years. But Barb was very defiant. I mean, she told me that the CAB report with Civil Aeronautics Board, the predecessor to the NTSB, was all wrong. They had the proof. People in town, the Dwyers, have told them that they still own the airplane and they have it and the proof is in that airplane. This idea of the bullet hole, you know, persists. Of course, everybody ignores the fact there was no bullet hole in the pilot. So that's, you know, a bullet hole in the seat isn't going to take down a plane. And so finally, with Barb's insistence that they know the truth, there's an open letter to Jerry Dwyer. We tried contacting Jerry. He wouldn't take our call. In the book, that it's just saying, I have assembled a team of investigators. I've got one of the lead investigators for the NTSB who is more than willing to take a look at this plane. There is technology today that exists that didn't exist in 1959, and we can put it to rest. You know, if the Dwyers are correct, something else brought down that plane, let's expose it. If they're not correct, then they have nothing to lose because right now it's the general consensus, pilot error. I agree. And let's find out.
And your conclusion is that it was pilot error.
Oh, absolutely. It was, you know, and I hate using words like irresponsibility, but if you take that pilot with those low hours, the fact that he had just recently failed his instrument examination, you put him in a high-performance airplane that's fully loaded to its weight capacity, and you put him in that error, that flight wasn't in doubt. The only surprise would be if that flight would have made it. That flight was doomed from the second that they closed the doors on that airplane. And the fact that in Jerry Dwyer's own account, he said that he stood outside. And at the time, one of the accounts I heard was 17 below zero. He stood outside and watched that plane till it was out of sight. Why? Unless he was worried. So that plane should have never left the ground. And everybody would agree with that, I'm sure, including Jerry Dwyer now.
I want to talk for just the few minutes that we have left about the music of Buddy Holly, Ritchie Valens, the Big Bopper, and what it means to people today. And Gary, I know you focused on Buddy Holly, so I'll start with Jeff. What do you think the influence of these three performers is today and continues to be?
Well, there's a very profound interest in continuing interest in their musical legacy, and that reminds me of a story. It's probably been 10 years, and most of the people come for Buddy. Let's be honest. But I was out at the memorial site with a fairly large group, and it was in the winter, and an elderly Hispanic gentleman was there with his family, and. I got done with my little spiel that I normally do out there, and everybody started to walk back to the road, and this gentleman just stood there and was kind of stone-faced. I shouldn't say stone-faced because he was very emotional, and then the tears just rolled out of his eyes. He says, "We're here because of Ritchie," and Ritchie was such an influence on our community, It was just incredible to see the emotion that was pouring out of him at that time, probably 40 years after Ritchie had passed.
A lot of power still there. And Gary, obviously, Buddy Holly's music moved you tremendously many, many years later. And you write about a lot of people who this music means a lot to. We know that it's been tremendously influential to many other musicians, including the Beatles and countless others. But what does Buddy Holly mean today?
Well, I think Buddy Holly is a reflection of all of us and what you can do if you are passionate and you have a love for something. You know, he was a young man who was, by all accounts, he wasn't a great student. He was just passionate about the music. And, you know, the influence that he's had has been amazing and continues to have. And it is an absolute fact, when you start listening to music from the 60s and the 70s on, you can hear a little bit of Buddy in all of that. And I think that his legacy is that he started it all and it continues to live through it today.
One of the things that you write about with him and his music is that it's such joyful music. And,
oh, it is.
And you write about him just being such a pleasant, happy person who just wanted to make people happy.
He really did. And he continues to make people happy today. And I think if Buddy, you know, for Buddy to know the impact, I mean, he no one could have imagined February 2nd in 1959, when he put that guitar away for the last time, that music would live on. And 52 years later, you know, I didn't want to use the word genius, and I still hesitate because the music's so simple, but complexity has never been a criteria for the judgment of genius. And the fact that he's more popular today than ever before, I think, says his music is genius.
Gary, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Jeff, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Gary Moore is the author of Hey Buddy, In Pursuit of Buddy Holly, My New Buddy John, and My Lost Decade of Music. Jeff Nicholas is president of the North Iowa Cultural Center and Museum, located in the Surf Ballroom. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Brian Dow. You can send us email anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And tomorrow at 10 o'clock, Governor Branstad will be giving his budget address. We'll be broadcasting that live tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock. This is Talk of Iowa.
Well, that'll be the day when you say goodbye. Yes, that'll be the day when you make me cry. You say you're gonna leave. You know it's a lie, 'cause that'll be the day when I die. Well, you give me all your loving and your dirty loving, all your hugs and kisses and your money too. Well, you know you love me, baby. Tell me maybe that someday